Each time we have a session, there's a new batch of people. So I feel a little obliged to do a refresh. But I thought of a very nice way to do it. I anticipated. So, I thought I would read from Bhurijan Prabhu's Under His Lotus Feet, the section that we're studying from, chapter 30, because I like Bhurijan, and I like Bhurijan's writing and uses it very nicely. And for those of you that have attended everything, no problema. It's just, you know, a nice appreciation of a very nice devotee appreciating a very wonderful section of Srimad Bhagavatam. I think I'll just, even before I read that, just a little appreciation about Srimad Bhagavatam. There's so many nice things to say about Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam is called Srimad Bhagavatam, or Bhagavat Purana, because it introduces the Vedic wisdom's teaching that the absolute truth is Bhagavan. Of course, we know from Srimad Bhagavatam, the absolute truth has different features that are all of the same advayam, or absolute nature. Dvaya, or dualism, is something we find here. What does dualism mean? You know what dualism means? Two. Wherever there's this, there's that. There's light and there's dark. There's hot and there's cold. There's pleasure, there's pain. There's honor, there's dishonor. There's this and there's that. This world is a world of duality. Wherever there is, there's something its opposite. That's the nature of the place. And there's another place, a place that's non-dual, where everything is absolute. So by a philosophical point, but by abstraction or definition by negation, the non-dual realm must be homogenized. No distinctions. Put the distinctions in a blender, turn it on high speed for a long time, and you get non-dual. That's one notion. Definition by negation is called Brahman. Then there's another, that not only is all pervasive Brahman aspect of the absolute, besides the all pervasive, there's localized, which sounds like the opposite of all pervasive. But the supersoul is also everywhere within the material world. Although the material world is a place of duality, the expansion of Paramatma is within every atom. And in between every atom, it is, he's also everywhere, but he's a localized feature of the absolute. Then there's a third. That's Bhagavan. And the Bhagavan feature is the absolute truth is a person. That from which everything comes is a person. And in that absolute truth that's a person that expands everything everywhere isn't reduced by expanding everything everywhere, because he has unlimited potencies. Otherwise, he's not the supreme person. He's like one of us that's limited. Can you expand yourself everywhere? Monks? No. Okay. None of us can do that because we're not Bhagavan. But Bhagavan can expand himself everywhere and he's not reduced. And he's a person. And his personality is not reduced by expanding himself everywhere. So there's these three non-dual features. Many of you know the verse. It's a key verse in the Bhagavad Purana. If you know the verse, you can recite it with me. Vedanta tat tatva vidas tatvam yajgyanam advayam rameti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabdyate. Very key verse in the whole of Srimad Bhagavatam, which teaches that the absolute truth, those learned persons know, those who have carefully studied the Vedas and have reached the conclusion of the Vedas, Vedanta, they know that the absolute truth that is of this non-dual nature, again, what is duality? Wherever there's something, there is its opposite. There's another realm where there's not things that have their opposite, but everything is non-dual. But the interesting part of that is there's variegatedness that's not non-dual. It's all absolute. You know, for the mind on this material plane, it doesn't process, because the mind on this plane is also a manifestation of duality. It's a binary processor. Some of you may know IT terminology. Computers are binary processors. I don't know so much about it, but people have told me. So one and zero and combinations of one and zeros makes computers. And computers just mirror the activities of the mind. It's a binary processor. It's a one or a zero. And you filter things, write a program. It's just, I don't know how to do it, but combinations of ones and zeros, and you make a program. And you get stuff through, so that's what minds do also. So the mind, it's inconceivable. The Sanskrit term is achintya. Achintya means not conceivable. So the realm of that has variety for the material mind is inconceivable. Because it would be like this. Wherever there's variety, there's duality. Have I lost anybody yet? I'll give an example. For example, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, in the spiritual world, there's no need of sunlight, moonlight, or electricity. Why? Because everything there is self-luminous. Correct? Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita. So, wouldn't you be happy to know that in Goloka Vrindavan, there's day and there's night? Well, that sounds like duality to me, right? Day and night. There's opposites, day and night. Light and no light. There's duality. Can't be a world of duality if it's got duality. I mean, can't be a world of absolutes if it's got duality. But those positions of day and night are exhibitions of the non-dual internal potency making the affect or the appearance of day and night. But it's actually just Krishna's exhibiting his potencies. Another example. For example, Bhagavad Gita says there's no need of sunlight, moonlight, or electricity. But there's a moon. And the moon gives moonlight. There's no need for it. But there's a moon. And not only there's a moon, but it's a full moon every night. Cool, huh? Why? Because it's for pastimes of Krishna. He likes full moons, so it's full moon for his pastimes. And so forth. It's the realm of absolutes, not the duality that we experience here, where there's variegatedness. And there's infinite potency. This is the nature of Bhagavan. So of the first of the Jiva Goswami's writing of the Sandarbhas, just after explaining Srimad Bhagavatam is the ultimate pramana. Pramana means the way of knowing something, or valid source of knowledge, pramana. He then explains prameya, that which is knowable by that valid source of knowledge. And he starts with Bhagavan. He doesn't start with Brahman. He starts with Bhagavan. Because Jiva Goswami wants to demonstrate, I'm entertaining you a little bit with some of the studies of the Sandarbhas that I've been engaged in. It's very nice. Jiva Goswami came in the course, Lord Chaitanya's line, and in Lord Chaitanya's line, there's no commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Why is there no commentary on Vedanta Sutra? Because in all the other sampradayas, even in Madhvacharya, he wrote a commentary on Brahma's or Vedanta Sutra, and Ramanujacharya and Vishnu Swami and the other great acharyas. Lord Chaitanya didn't. Why? He said Srimad Bhagavatam is that commentary. So in Lord Chaitanya's line, Jiva Goswami was the first taking the teachings that he heard from his two uncles, Sanatana Goswami and Rupa Goswami, writing the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, because Lord Chaitanya said Srimad Bhagavatam is that commentary on Vedanta Sutra. So Jiva Goswami wrote a commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the commentary on Vedanta Sutra. And he did it in a comprehensive and systematic way. Two terms. Comprehensive. He covered everything, and very systematic. He didn't cover, you know, details and details. He took essences from Srimad Bhagavatam, and the most important starting point of essences, a key message of Srimad Bhagavatam, is Bhagavan. God is a person. And what does it mean that God is a person? Well, he is the source of everything. He has unlimited potencies. And he has relationships with those potencies, including the living entities, all living entities, which then leads into the next Sandarbha, which is Paramatma Sandarbha. He's within the heart of every living entity in the material world. But in the spiritual world, he's there as Bhagavan, Krishna, playing his flute, or Narayan in Vaikuntha. He's Bhagavan. Both are Bhagavan. And so, by definition, Bhagavan means a person in the spiritual realm, non-dual person, who is the source of everything and has unlimited potencies. And that's the highest truth. Srimad Bhagavatam is the highest source of knowledge. That's in the first of the Sandarbhas. And the starting entry point into what does this Srimad Bhagavatam reveal is the Bhagavad Purana. He reveals Bhagavan. Bhagavat means in relation to Bhagavan. It's a Sanskrit ending that means Bhagavat. Means in relation to Bhagavan. So he starts with Sandarbha out of six. So he, the supreme, so Kapiladeva, the section that we're discussing, he's teaching devotional service. All the four yugas, it's devotional service and devotional service, we mentioned this morning. And in order to understand devotional service, one needs to understand Bhagavan, devotional service unto whom? And what's the agency of our devotional service? It's one of his potencies, his internal potency. But if the internal potency connects you to Bhagavan, what if you don't like the internal potency? Well, you have the external potency by default. And what does the external potency look like? That's what chapter 30 is. The living entity that doesn't recognize Bhagavan wants to be Bhagavan. or at least as close as we can get to it, that's Hiranyakashipu. We're reading at the Chicago Temple Hiranyakashipu's Sankalpa. As he's doing his austerities, what does he want? He wants as close to God as he can get, and since, as far as he's concerned, there's no Bhagavan, he wants to be Lord Brahma. He's like the biggest guy that all the demigods worship, and do so eternally. That's what he wants. He wants to be God. At least his conception of what God is, the Creator. And since Lord Brahma got the post of being the creator by austerity, so I'll do bigger austerities than he did, and I'll bump him off. Which, the logic is, if you can bump off Lord Brahma, then somebody can bump you off too. So you're not God either, nor is he, because you can bump him off. It's quite illogical, but that's okay. If when you're Maya, you can be illogical and get away with it. At least live your life that way. So, Kapila wishes us to understand Bhagavan and be engaged in devotional service to Bhagavan. Again, what is Bhagavan? That's Srimad Bhagavatam is revealing Bhagavan. He who is the source of everything, who is a person, and who has unlimited potencies. And by the extending and withdrawing and mixing of these various potencies, everything in the material and everything in the spiritual world becomes manifest. And the wise connect with the internal potency and a loving relationship with the Supreme Loving Person. That's the teaching. And now we're getting a message of detachment from the position of forgetting Bhagavan and trying to be the enjoyer otherwise. The default position, the material activities position, and the unwanted outcomes that are the result of fruitive activities, adverse fruitive activities. That's the chapter. It's to help us come to shelter in Bhagavan, the Supreme Person. Impetus to take shelter of Bhagavan. So now, especially for those of you that are joining us just now, I'm just going to read, and for those of you that have attended, you get a nice appreciation of what a wonderful writer Bhurijan Prabhu is. Here's chapter 30 of Under His Lotus Feet, chapter 30, canto 3. Concluding cluster of verses at the end of chapter 29 speaks about time, and time is eternal. It has no beginning. It has no end. It influences everything that is, does have a beginning and end. It moves matter. It moves events that cause activities within the realm of matter. So now I'm just going to read sections. His subheading is text 1-5, Time's Deluding Effect. Lord Kapila further explained the ramifications of time's actions, namely, although time and its consequences are powerful and obvious, consciously or unconsciously, we seem to choose to remain blind to its devastating effects. And he quotes Kapila speaking verses 2 and 3. Kapila Muni provides a metaphor, namely, as clouds remain unaware of the wind that pushes them across the sky, a conditioned soul remains unaware that it is the time factor mixed with his karma, not his free choice, that determines his actions. Srila Prabhupada notes in his purport that quote, "Unfortunately, those who are not in Krishna consciousness are carried away by the strong power of time without their knowledge, as clouds are carried by the wind." Paragraph. Kapila Muni is speaking in such strong words to Devahuti to inspire detachment, because the materially attached are unable to become attached to Krishna's lotus feet. Of Bhagavad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Purana is to become attached to Bhagavan. So one of the primary obstacles of becoming attached to Bhagavan is being attached to duality and the expectation in this realm of duality of some illusory happiness. And as I was reading this section, I was also thinking, you know, that passage where Prahlad speaking to his students, his classmates, not his students, but the teachers leave the classroom. Sunda and Amarka leave the classroom. So what do kids do when a teacher leaves the classroom? They want to play. So Prahlad says, no, no, no. Let us engage in devotional service. And then gives the explanation why. Because human form of life is rarely achieved, and one shouldn't waste a moment. And then he goes through this whole description, as is happening in this chapter 30, of stages of life. And in different stages of life, there's some involvement in matter. Of course, matter is very expert at configuring itself to match the mentality of the living entity age by age in their life. Something that keeps one very, very busy. For children, it's like to play and so forth and so on throughout life. So Bhujan writes, Prahlad Maharaj makes the same point, Bhagavatam 7:5:30, because of their uncontrolled senses, persons too addicted to materialistic life make progress towards hellish conditions and repeatedly chew that which has already been chewed. You know that punak charvat, the charva nanam, Prabhupada would say over and over. Punak charvat, the charva nanam. They just chew the chewed. You know, you take some gum and put it on your bedpost. Then the next day you take the gum that's been chewed already and you chew it again. And put it back again, and then the next morning pick it up and chew it again. People do it. They chew the chewed. That's Prahlad is saying. Their inclination toward Krishna are never aroused. Why? Because of attachment. So then detachment helps becoming attached to Krishna. Still, so now Bhurijan continues, still, whether or not one is attached to matter, the Lord in his form as time will crush and destroy everything material one has accumulated by his hard work and good fortune. The material world is truly a holocaust. Nothing survives, neither the king nor his kingdom. He's a good writer, isn't he? Paragraph. The Lord's time energy combines with Maya to cause one to mistake the temporary for permanent. One then foolishly becomes overwhelmed by and entangled in the temporary. And he quotes Prabhupada speaking in his purport. In the purport to text 2, Srila Prabhupada summarizes the crushing effect of time. Quote, the main function of the time factor, which is a representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is to destroy everything. Note that the time factor doesn't work in the spiritual world that way. There's nothing created, nothing destroyed. It's eternal. But time energy here brings things into being. Main place after some time. the materialists in material consciousness are engaged in producing so many things in the name of economic development. They think that by advancing and satisfying the material needs of man, they will be happy. But they forget that everything they've produced will be destroyed in due course of time. From history, we can see that there were many powerful empires on the surface of the globe that were constructed with great pain and great perseverance, but in due course of time, they've all been destroyed. We mentioned this morning, some nations are still at it. They haven't learned. They're building their empires. Still, the foolish materialists cannot understand that they're simply wasting time in producing material necessities which are destined to be vanquished in due course of time. End of paragraph. That's the temporary nature of things that inspires detachment, but then more. Kapila Muni next explains that a soul relishes the specific type of happiness offered by his body, regardless of the quality of that body, or even the species he inhabits. He compares humans to ants. Ants are also attached. They got their ant colony and mom and dad and kids, and you know, they've got their whole program going on. So although an ant and a human are vastly different in bodily form, this characteristic is similar. Every embodied soul identifies with the body it inhabits and endeavors to maintain happiness. Deluded by Maya, each entity aims both to be satisfied and devoid, casting off its body. Live forever. Prabhupada comments like that. There's an ant moving. You put your hand or something, an object, in front of the ant. He'll move around. Or something that puts the ant in danger. He wants to survive. It's instinctive. Wishing eternal life is intrinsic to every living entity because the soul is eternal. We want eternal life because the soul is eternal. Why? You know, somebody might say, well, it's just, you know, it's in the genes. It's how the genes are configured. Anyway, how do the genes get configured the way they're configured? Where does that impetus come from? The soul is actually eternal. Even in the residents of hell delight in the specific pleasures. They delight in the specific pleasures of that realm. That one experiences satisfaction in any species, even though one's life is objectively abominable, is proof that he's illusioned in the material world. The illusion of identifying with the body is unassailable. Nothing you can do can check it. Try this and that. Paragraph. One should remember, however, that it is not the objects in this world that are Maya. Rather, illusion bewitches the conditioned souls into viewing the temporary objects both as if they were permanent and as if they existed simply for their pleasure. It's not the fault of the object, it's the consciousness that we're carrying. In addition, due to Maya's potent spell, the conditioned souls imagine that the objects themselves bring happiness. Souls in Maya's kingdom therefore continue their frustrating attempts to combine their senses with the sense objects that, regardless of the specific nature of particular bodies, all embodied souls remain addicted to petty, self-centered, so-called pleasure. It's helping. For those of you that attended the earlier sessions, it's just a very nice summary. Prabhupada describes the mystifying effect of Maya in his purport for text 5. I won't read it. And then he goes on the same theme, text 4. The mystifying effect, just examples of the mystifying effects of the material energy. looks pretty neutral. There's a yellow wall. There's a nice door with glass, and there's this, and there's that. There's some trees, and there's some birds, and there's some people walking out on the sidewalk out there, and cars passing by us. In neutral. The objects are neutral, but the consciousness behind the sense perception is not neutral. It's I like, I don't like. Happiness and distress. Let me pursue, let me get one of those, let me get five of those, let me get a different colored one, and so on. And then, you know, the hankering for enjoyment in the field of senses contacting sense objects. That's verses 1 through 5. And then we're going to go through text 19. So we ended this morning with text 13. And then we'll continue 14 through 19. But this is a short summary of 6 through 19. He's including this as a section called Time as Portrayed in the Life of an Illusioned Human. So if you remember from, you know, the very first verse, it's pay attention to first verses of chapters because it's like, do, 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 do. It's like giving you heads up what's coming. So the first verse speaks of that metaphor of time moving matter like wind moving a cloud, but the cloud doesn't know how the wind is moving it, although it's being moved. So also living entities, our experience of the transitory phases of life, it's being moved by time. So now he goes into the following, you know, my life is quite perfect in whatever species. Then, okay, now you're in a species, and now, then there's stages of transformations and stages of life. And the deluding influence, having once identified with it, and thinking there's happiness within it, although I'm not peaceful at all. Detachment through knowledge. Kapila Muni continues to describe the imperceptible effects of time as it acts to move a human from one stage of life to the next. Souls and human bodies tend to think of themselves as, quote, quite perfect, because they possess, quote, deep-rooted attraction for body. Then, wife, home, children, animals, wealth, and friends. Just hearing Kapila's description of materialistic human life fills one with fear. Scare tactic, right? Two short sentences in Srila Prabhupada's purport to text 7 work to undermine the, quote, nuclear family. That's a modern term for those of you that don't know the term. It just means a single family. Like there's the extended family notion that you, many of you know from India, then the nuclear family. Like, you know, it's a modern term where people don't even know who their neighbor is. They don't say, you know, hello, Hari Bol. It's just like, it is the nuclear family. They don't have connections so much. So that's the, you know, father, mother, and children. That's the nuclear family. And the nuclear family, according to this modern outlook, is it's the basis of civilization. In any case, Bhurijan is saying, Kapila Deva is addressing that, cutting the legs out from under that notion. And you know, and the life itself and the means of maintaining the family by whatever means, we heard this morning. Yet despite all endeavors, Kapila explains, a materialist remains unable to satisfy his family members. He grieves his failure deeply and suffers reversals at work. He is disrespected by others and tortured by greed. Gradually he loses his beauty, means with old age, and becomes deformed and invalid in his old age. He quotes text 15. Thus he prepares to meet death. In his old age, his throat rattles and his lungs are congested. We didn't read that yet. That's coming attractions. With mucus, he can breathe only with difficulty, quoting text 17. Soon he'll be forced to die and leave his family members behind. The rest of it is primarily quotes just from Prabhupada's purports, very graphic descriptions. Sometimes a dying man entrusts the family affairs on or some. I'm going, please look after the family. He does not know where he is going. But even at the time of death, he is anxious about how his family will be maintained. Sometimes it is seen that a dying man requests a physician to increase his life at least for a few years. Prabhupada describes there was one friend of his, a business companion or acquaintance, very wealthy man. And he was diagnosed with some terminal disease. The doctor said, you only have a short, so much time to live. He said, doctor, I'll give you all my wealth. Just give me a few more years so I can finish my plans. Doctor said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. Time's up. These are the material diseases of the conditioned soul. He completely forgets his real engagement. What's that? To become Krishna conscious. And is always serious about planning to maintain his family, although he changes families one after another. That's the end of that section through verse 19. So for those of you that joined us, that's a little summary of this section that we've gotten to so far. So we're going to be, we finished with text 13. Where's Subal? Huh? He's gone to work. Okay. I was going to call on him because he had some interest in the message of text 13. Well, it was text 10. Text 10. Text 13 introduces the topic of, you know, the stage of life where one is very old, and the metaphor is used like old for the farmer that can no longer plow the field. The old bull becomes a burden. The farmer isn't happy anymore with the old bull because he can't plow the field. So it's just like, it's not treated nicely. It's just a little anecdote just to break the philosophy here for a moment. There was a period of time when Niranjana Maharaj and I were both serving in Boston Temple. He was the temple president. Somehow I was serving as the regional secretary. And our book distributors met people that were from all over the place. Maybe some of you know, this is, coming year is ISKCON 50. You know what that means, ISKCON 50? You know the meaning, ISKCON 50? No idea, right? You, ISKCON 50, you know the meaning? What is it? Tell me. Very good. ISKCON was formally incorporated in 1966. So that means, actually, it starts in 2015, because that marks the beginning of the 50th. But we're mostly going to be doing it. So when Prabhupada arrived in Boston Harbor, before ISKCON was formed in 1966, he arrived in the Boston Harbor. So they're having a big festival in Boston in the third weekend of September. This is an advertisement. If your schedule permits, please go. In fact, the weekend before that, there's going to be the kickoff for North America ISKCON having a celebration starting the 50th anniversary celebration in Houston, organized by TSI. What's TSI? The Sangha Initiative. It's a group of devotees, some of whom are in the room, our younger generation devotees that are going to be organizing this wonderful event in Houston, Texas. So come on, y'all, and join the party. Second weekend in September. And then the weekend after that, is Prabhupada's arrival in Boston Harbor, the first event, celebrating when Prabhupada came. And one of the places where they're holding, it's like 5 days, and, you know, they've really organized it so nicely. TSI should get inspiration from how well they've organized. It's like really organized. One of the events is going to be at a place called Faneuil Hall, and the mayor and the ambassador from India and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da and all these, you know, VIP people are going to be at Faneuil Hall along with, guess what? Kirtan, of course. And, you know, messages of what ISKCON has done. They're going to say what ISKCON has done, and we're going to also say thank you very much for your appreciation. So, and festivals held in the Boston Common, and they've really made a fantastic plan. Now I forget why I'm telling you that story. Yes, thank you. So, somebody was met at Faneuil Hall. A book distributor met this couple that had a farm in Maine. For those of you who don't know your U.S. geography, Maine is one of the 50 states. And it's kind of north of Boston. You know, that thing that sticks up like that, that's Maine. And so the Sankirtan devotee kept in touch with his family because they were like really appreciative. And they finally invited us to come and visit them. They wanted some devotee association. So we went, it's a long drive from Boston to Maine, let me tell you. Phew. And we finally got there. And the man had read Bhagavad Gita, and he was trying to be vegetarian. And then he took us out to the cow barn. It was really nice, because like he stood there, and he was identifying one by one. There's Sally, and she's going to stick her neck out and want me to scratch under her chin. And there's this other one. She's going to stand back and wait for me to call her name, and then she'll come up. And they all had their personalities, and he knew exactly their personalities. And it was in the beginning part of winter, so it was cold. And then he shared an experience that he had. We're, you know, sitting at a table talking, and he said, God saved my life. This is after he got his Bhagavad Gita. Just excuse the storytelling, but it's nice. So he said, in this rural situation, people have to take care of each other. We can't survive. It's very cold. And there isn't an infrastructure. We have to look after each other. So one of my friends, that lives on the other side of a ravine, his tractor got stuck. So I had to go and help him get his tractor unstuck. So as I was driving, there's a single lane bridge that crosses over the ravine. And I thought, wow, it's really slippery. I better be really careful, drive really slowly. And what happened was, It was just a patch of ice, and I put on the brakes as I was going down the hill to cross the bridge, and the car was going not in the direction of the bridge. And I realized, that's it. This is it. And then I started praying. You know, it's like Yad Barat falling off the cliff, you know? Bharat Maharaj falling off the cliff. But because he had received Bhagavad Gita and association devotees, he said, God has some calling for me. Let me take shelter of him. And he didn't use that language, but he prayed very intently. Then all of a sudden, just as the car was about to go off the edge of the single lane bridge, it moved and then went across the other side of the bridge and up and came to a stop. He thought, God saved my life. So he wants me to do some service for him. So I talk about gratitude, right? Now I must serve him. So we were going, wow. So, you know, what do you see as that service? And what he saw as the service was, I want to give leadership in the community amongst the farmers, because farmers are being squeezed by the corporate people. The people that sell the grain, the people that give the mortgage for the farm, and the people that sell the equipment, they're squeezing, that go up, and you can't be a farmer unless you play the game. So standing up with the farmers, no, you can't do this. And that's his calling. You know, the protecting the squeezed farmers. Okay. And then it was time for meal, and he was eating meat. We said, how can you do this? You read Bhagavad Gita and you read this other book, you know, Higher Taste. And the cows. You know them by personality, by name and everything. How can you eat them? How can you do that? We were like blunt, right in the middle, as he's like, because the relationship was like that. And God has saved you, and what are you doing? He said, well, you know, you can't maintain the economy of being a farmer unless you do it. He said, well, you know, you're fighting for the cause of the farmers, why not fight for this cause, and for the cause of the cows? And you fight for it. Go ahead, fight for it, but don't eat them. Well, I need the protein. Well, you don't need the protein. Here's the explanation. You don't need the protein. So it's just, when there's attachment, you pashyati na pashyati. You see, but you can't see. It's exactly what's here. The impermanent looks permanent. And what is distress looks like happiness, although they know it's distress. It's the deluding force of Maya when one is attached. So, again, this section is to help help become detached. And then if you don't become detached when you have vitality, are you going to become detached when your vitality is gone? Not likely. Likely you'll follow the same pattern that you followed when you were young, when you're old, and you're attached. Exactly what Prahlad Maharaj says, one should learn from childhood. Tender age of childhood. Komara acharet pragyo dharman bhagavataniha. There's symmetry within the message of Bhagavatam. Okay, back to text 14. Deformed by the influence of old age, he prepares himself to meet ultimate death. This is the time energy moving the soul within this cloud-like situation of material existence, slowly bringing oneself closer to the edge of the cliff, death. Thus he remains at home just like a pet dog and eats whatever is so negligently given to him. Of course, it's not always yucky like that. But more so than, didn't Our youth group out here in Naperville, once upon a time, have programs at old age homes, because I saw some pictures. Yes? So you went to places where people are elderly or whatever it is. And what was it like? Very sad, wasn't it? And, you know, seeing young people coming in and chanting and bright-faced and happy and message of Krishna, you know, little spark of life went, wow, and then you'll prasadam and then you left. So it was nice to give them that sense of purpose and meaning. But, you know, old age isn't a happy time. It's one of the four miseries. We know what disease is like, and that's not fun. Old age isn't fun either. Death certainly isn't fun. And life within the womb, there's somebody to the tribe making a little video on illustrating the verses of the Bhagavatam as, you know, the conception of the living entity and the living entity within the womb. It's really well done. And again, it's not fun. It's, Bhagavatam depicts it. And so also the life of fruitive activities and the old age for one who has lived their life in fruitive activities. There's no shelter. Senses won't function properly. You're not able to serve those who you were serving your whole life. Anyway, a burden in one sense. And such people often, they say, you know, pull the plug. There's too much pain. I don't want to continue like this. Afflicted with many illnesses such as dyspepsia. Any of our physicians know what dyspepsia is? You can't digest, right? Huh? Heartburn. Indigestion. Okay. And loss of appetite. Because the Sanskrit is apradipa agni. Apradipa agni. That's fire and fire. Heartburn. And loss of appetite. He eats only very small morsels of food. And he becomes invalid, can't move around, who cannot work anymore. Now, in Prabhupada's purport, it's fiery. He says, before you get to that stage, don't stay in that, you know, unfortunate circumstance, similar to what Vidura says to Dhritarashtra. I'll just read a bit. Vedic literature enjoins that before the arrival of such miserable conditions, one should leave home and die without the knowledge of his family members. If a man leaves home and dies without his family's knowing, that is considered a glorious death. But an attached, because here's the alternative, and an attached family man, without God consciousness, wants his family members to carry him in a great procession, even after his death, although he will not even be able to see how the procession goes. He still desires that his body be taken gorgeously in procession. Thus he is happy without even knowing where he has to go when he leaves his body for the next. So, for devotees, when this situation comes, what do? We gather around and have kirtan and read Srimad Bhagavatam and speak Krishna Katha, so that as the soul leaves the body, that auspiciousness is generated and consciousness goes to that sound vibration. There was a very nice devotee. Maybe some of you know Shaibya, who lives in New Jersey, Shaibya and Premarnava. If you don't know them, they'll be most likely coming to Giranagari. They come and set up a little camp. They have two little boys run around like, shh. That's Shaibya and Premadava. So her profession is she's a nurse, and then she specialized in hospice care. So before she actually got into hospice care, she had the opportunity. There was one congregation member. His name was Godfrey. He and his friend were like rock musicians for Krishna, of course. And he has some terminal disease. So I went to visit, and maybe his friend was Richard and Godfrey. So he was lying in bed. He was going. So lying in bed, up on the ceiling, there's a picture of Radha Govinda and a picture of Prabhupada. And the only thing that I could see that was moving in his body was his eyes. His eyes were going from Prabhupada to Radha Govinda and Radha Govinda to Prabhupada and like that. And he could move his finger. So when we had kirtan, his finger was doing like this. The rest of his body, he had lost muscular movement. And Shaibya was with him for, you know, till he left his body, and periodically with a Q-tip putting Vaseline on his lips because his lips would become dry, and people that know hospice care know that it's very uncomfortable when you can't even move your tongue to lick your lips because it's dry. So just by, you know, the contentedness of this devotee was there were devotees. And the devotees were, what do devotees do? They were doing what devotees do, bhajana kriya, having kirtan, and reciting Srimad Bhagavatam. And even when the devotees weren't there, then some lectures of Srila Prabhupada or kirtans of Srila Prabhupada or, you know, the famous kirtaneers of those times was Vishnujan and others. And he left his body in that condition, which is altogether different than this. It's glorious, as opposed to miserable. Leaving the body isn't fun, but leaving the body in this condition is glorious. I mean, when this is a great personality, but when somebody has that, just like Rupa Sanatan, some of you know, Rupa Sanatan was a brahmachari, temple president in St. Louis. He was diagnosed with cancer. He tried this and that and the other thing to overcome. It didn't work. He went to Vrindavan for leaving his body. And it was really fantastic. I mean, sad, but fantastic. The way that he left his body was fantastic. There were 30 people in the room having this uproarious kirtan. Because the physician that was attending him, he knew that by symptoms, it's about to happen. In fact, I was in Mayapur attending a GBC meeting, and it was planned that I would call him and speak certain things that a person who's going to leave their body, it helps them to hear someone that's very important in their life, certain five key messages. And I wasn't in the room because I was in Mayapur attending our GBC meeting. But I remember very clearly speaking where I was standing and message, and the people in the room, the doctor said, started crying because, you know, there they are seeing this. Anyway, it's glorious in Vrindavan, in the association of devotees, hearing, you know, very loving and caring words. You're going, and Krishna's there. It's really wonderful. It's glorious. It's wonderful. As opposed to, you know, this is the adverse fruit of activities. If one's life has not been the cultivation of Krishna in the center of one's life, then these other things, you know, one is very attached. Let's hear some more. Text 16. In that diseased condition, one's eyes bulge due to the pressure of air from within, and his glands become congested with mucus. So, you know, doshas become out of balance. Too much air, too much mucus. You can't speak. He has difficulty breathing, and upon exhaling and inhaling, he produces a sound like... can't do it. Gura, gura. That's what it says in the Sanskrit too. A rattling within the throat. In this way, he comes under the clutches of death and lies down, surrounded by lamenting friends and relatives, and although he wants to speak with them, he no longer can, because he is under the control of time. Purport, Prabhupada, the dying man, "Oh, my father," he wants to say, "Oh, my friend," or "Oh, my husband," in that pitiable condition. The dying man wants to speak with them and instruct them of his desires, but because he is fully under the control of the time factor, death, he cannot express himself, and that causes him inconceivable pain. We're almost done. Thus, the man who engaged with uncontrolled senses in maintaining a family dies in great grief, seeing his relatives crying. He dies most pathetically, in great pain and without consciousness. That's what we don't want. We want Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada told the story that, well, we know that during his travel on the Jaladuta, he had two heart attacks and wrote that if I have a third, I'll surely die. It didn't happen. 1 year later, after staying in America, he had his six-month tourist visa, visitor's visa extended. And then he had heart attack. He was taken to the Jersey Shore for recovery. "Don't let them hook me up to those machines with tubes." He said that one of his godbrothers, they had done that, and he died a vegetable. Don't let them do that. If they insist, put your foot down. I'll put it in writing. Don't let them do this. Because, you know, he wanted to die in Krishna consciousness, not as a vegetable. And he did. At death, he sees the messengers of the Lord of Death. Who's that? Yamadutas. Yikes, right? Their eyes full of wrath and in great fear. He passes stool and urine. Loses controls of his involuntary nervous system out of fear. That's the end of the section. In the previous purport, Prabhupada writes, "The common man does not know the destiny of his life. He is simply busy in his flash of life maintaining his family." And it's so the disease is the infirmity of the body, but the material disease is the broader picture. So that's what Kapila Dev is warning Devahuti against. Don't come to that stage. He's advising us. Don't come to that stage. Is there an alternative? Yes. Read chapters 25, 27, 28, and 29. Engage in devotional service in a proper way. Cultivate shelter at the lotus feet of Bhagavan, because this attachment will obstruct taking shelter and what will cling and hold on to the limited and temporary, never set circumstances of life. I'm debating, as we're going further in this chapter, did I pick the right chapter? It's like, ooh, pretty heavy. But anyway, it's in the Bhagavatam, right? So it's good for us. Let us take shelter of Krishna instead. Any comments or questions? You can go back to some of the things that we discussed earlier if you wish. Yes.
From the earlier class, talked about cow production, and they liked it, but when we have to talk to them, like, how does it really, like, help? I mean, there's no way, I mean, to understand cow versus other animals. Why cow?
Why? I'm trying to listen carefully to your question. It's easy to talk something, but I'd like to know what your question is. What's this, why cows and not other forms, other animal forms, specifically is your question? What's your question?
How to explain to, like, the general public, like the teenagers?
But that's very broad. Can you make it a little more narrow? How do you explain? If I had to give a class to teenagers, what would I say about cow protection? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Okay. Depends on, you know, the group. But something very similar to what, I would begin with something very similar to what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said to Chan Kazi. What did Chan, what, you know, Chan Kazi, the dialogue? So he said, Lord Chaitanya said, the cow is like a mother. Why? Why do I say that? Because in addition to the milk of the mother, a child commonly is raised also with cow milk. So cow is like the mother. Cow is one of our mothers. So we don't kill our mother. What kind of principle to live by is that one? We don't kill our mother, so we shouldn't kill the cow. But, you know, we can say further things about not only not kill the cow, but protect the cow. And then we can say many things about protecting the cow. For example, it depends on the audience, but think about it, my dear high school kids. Animals, most animals, have some means of defense to protect themselves. They have sharp teeth, or they have claws, or they have something by which they protect themselves. But examine the cow. The cow doesn't. So by design, by nature's design, the cow is meant to be protected by others. So it's our, in Vedic culture at least, we extend protection to those who need protection. Not only cows. Those in these other four categories, we extend protection to them too. Children need protection. What's a society like that doesn't protect children? Something wrong with that society. And a society that doesn't protect women. When I attended the, I could share this with them, when I attended the temple opening in the first of the three temples that we have in Guyana, the president of Guyana attended the function. And he was speaking on the stage. And he spoke two things. Necessity for Guyana to educate our children in such a manner our children wish to stay and help develop the country. You know, a nationalistic appeal, but education of our children is very important. And ISKCON has this value of educating children in spiritual values, religious values. And then he spoke about women and the necessity of protection of women. Because without these two things, you see, he was on a platform and even saying, my wife, she's very involved in helping with the children's education program and the protection of women program. Because this is an important, backbone of the well-being of our country, our glorious Guyana. So this isn't like a Hare Krishna person, this is a president of the country. Of course, he knew his audience, he was speaking principles that we also support. But in any culture to advance, it must give protection to those who require protection. That's a fundamental duty of a head of state, or people that are members of that system, that group of people, that nation or town or city or community or whatever, to give protection to those that require protection. So cows certainly, we receive service from them. They sustain our life. they're defenseless. They are therefore by design to be protected. Especially, animal husbandry is fine, you know, meaning taking care of animals rather than taking advantage of them because they're weaker. But especially those that require by nature design, God's design, they require protection. And then there's other things to be said, but that's like a starting point. So it's within Vedic culture we value protection of cows. And so it's very hurtful to sensibility to see mother being harmed. How does a child feel when he sees mother being harmed? It's very hurtful. So we wish to see. And there's different ways of facilitating that, but it requires sacrifice from those that are stronger to protect those that are weaker or needing protection. We sacrifice to do that. Go ahead.
Scientific.
Well, that's, we can go there too. That's okay. You want to hear some of the scientific? You can just go online and look all that stuff up. Yeah, there's plenty of it. Plenty of it. You know, on Mother's Day, I gave some of that stuff. Here's one, just a scientific. I haven't done this research online, but I've been told. So just, you know, I'm presuming that it's accurate. The amount of milk that a cow produces is more than a calf can take. In fact, if the cow, after the calf is fed, if the cow is not milked, the cow will become sick. Human society needs to milk the cow, otherwise the cow will become sick. So it's naturally a domestic animal. So when we have domestic animals, we don't kill them when they're no longer able to, you know, be fun for us or something like that. My dog got old, so I just, you know, bump him off. Isn't that nice? To all. Then.
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj.
Welcome back.
This morning class, the previous class, you spoke about the importance of training and education.
Yeah, I got a little carried away, didn't I?
Yeah. And almost, I'm not sure if I understood you properly when almost like you spoke that it was that we're just at the beginning of it, but when we go deeper, it's establishing this protection, especially of brahmanas and cows.
Yeah,
and which sounds to me that mostly establishing of an ashram type of, you know, environment. And in the process of us as a community trying to develop, you know, a Krishna conscious community around this center, have there been some very more specific guidelines that in ISKCON world have come, you know, in establishing this Vanashram environment, especially, you know, going towards that goal of being able to have a community that focus on that type of protection?
I had this discussion yesterday, and in short, let me edit what you just said. Vanashram has a big question mark over it. You extrapolated brahmanas and cows leads to Vanashram civilization. And in one sense, it does. You can't have the rest of the varnas if you don't have qualified brahmanas. The brahmanas are needed to guide the other divisions of society. So in one sense, yes. But in another sense, not necessarily, one might argue, because what Prabhupada spoke repeatedly, was that he wanted to create a class of first-class men, which means brahmanas, but higher means Vaishnavas, qualified Vaishnavas. And for qualified Vaishnavas, it's not, it requires training. To take someone who's unqualified to become qualified, training. And so training in Krishna consciousness, then go more deeply in training in Krishna consciousness. It's a long discussion, but we're not training people well. At any stage, this is my opinion. Something, but not well. But some examples of Brahminical culture that's slowly coming into place is Mayapur Academy is one, training people in not just deity worship, but there's 4 months that have different sectors. There's the worship of the deity, that's just one. Then there's cooking for the deity. Then there's yajnas. And then there's, you know, character and conduct and achar for a brahmana. 4 months. 4 months. And after 4 months of being in that, one has not only, you know, learned, but has developed character, you know, more the character and quality of a brahmana, so that they can not only go out and do the duty because they know how to do it, but they have something more than that. You follow? And another that I was also discussing is Brahminical training of administrators. You may or may not know, the GBC has put a whole moratorium. GBC members leaving the GBC body and replacing them with other GBC members, because we want qualified people to populate the new set of GBCs that replace those of us that are senior citizens now and need someone to replace us. So before doing that, we established a college. It took, so far it's now, a lot of time and energy. My estimate is between 500 and 600 hours of time of persons that have been organizing this. And there's now a college for persons that aren't necessarily going to become GBC members, but they're going to become supervisors of regions underneath a GBC member. We have a nice name for it, a zonal supervisor. This is like, it's just a training and education item for your information. Now, one can say, well, that's Varnashram, because you're training administrators. You're training some pujaris, brahmanas, and you're training people that can do another brahminical thing. You know, scripture training, Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhav, and so forth. Now here's something that's administrative training. So it's it, but it's just the beginning. Now they're learning a lot of good stuff, because there's a lot of good teachers, but it's just the beginning. I mean, you know the field of music. So, there's music, and then there's really knowing music. And then in any field of music, there's really knowing a particular field of music. Isn't it? Just keep going and down and down and down and detail and detail and detail, and there's more detail after that. One can become really refined in knowing about a particular field of music. And then there's music. So, we have a lot of waiting, a lot of distance to go. But the goal is, you know, extrapolated, this is the beginnings of establishing Varnashram Dharma, although one could certainly make that argument. But it's more precisely, it's enabling people that have some service to do, like be an administrator, or be a teacher, and have some training to be an administrator or a teacher before being an administrator or a teacher, or to assist you in that. Mainly, it's been, you know, seat of the pants. In, you know, street language. Rather than qualify somebody to do what we do all the time, you know, pastoral counseling. We do it all the time. Where's the training? Zippo. Well, when we have our intuition and we have what has been done to help us, but is there a system for training that? No. We have, here's another one over here. Grihastha counseling. Fortunately, by the grace of Krishna, there are devotees that are professionally trained to do that. One of them, one couple, came here. Yay! You know, but it's just the beginning. You get, so it's not exactly unfolding the Varnashram system. It's just taking care of the devotees. So if we can invite them to get married, there's someone that can train them in a skilled, standard, quality way and then help support them afterwards. Not necessarily, you know, there's an ashram. It's part of our ashram. But it's doing what we're already doing with some training and guidance. And, you know, we need much more of it. So now, whether or not that leads to Varnashram and what that means, ask any person. We've had this discussion. We have 33 GBC members. Ask 33 GBC members, you get 33 different answers. No consensus on what it is and how to do it. How to implement it. We need to discuss it. We need to develop, you know, some kind of consensus. Wish us luck. We haven't been successful so far. Does that address your question?
Yeah. I can ask a follow-up.
Okay, fine. Then there's another question after your question.
So then in terms of devotee caring and the power of, you know, training and providing those type of services that not necessarily, you know, we're fully trained or trained at all, but we still have to do it, I guess, you know, more or less we're gonna continue the same program that we've basically been having.
Sure. Hopefully having people more qualified to do what they're asked to do rather than just ask them to do something they really know how to do. My whole life in devotional service has been doing things I never was trained to do. Well, I was trained a little bit. One day, for 45 minutes, we got a lesson in how to play mridanga. Chandanacharya taught us. That's the only thing I can directly remember, honestly. And the rest was just go on Sankirtan and, you know, practice what he taught us for 45 minutes. And I've been too busy for... Anyway, so let us do things a little differently going forward in time. And we can't, like, make it just touch a magic wand and it's different. We have to... It's a lot of work to make it different. I'm appealing to those who appreciate being educated curiously, get trained... And then help, you know, increase the standards and variety and quality of our training and education. We need it to make this next generation of society better. I could say so much more about it, but I think that covers it.
This is my question, Maharaj. It's on the argument that cow is mother, so we drink, don't kill cow. Because cow is mother, because we drink cow's milk.
Yeah.
So we don't kill it on this argument. Like different cultures of the world drink different other milks. Like in deserts, they would drink camel's milk. The place of India where I was born, it's mostly buffalo milk.
Okay. Don't kill buffalo either.
So that regard is not given to other animals. It's only given to cow. It's just because that cow has the milk is good for spiritual life. None of the other milk are good for spiritual life.
There's religious messages that, according to scripture, which we place our faith in the scripture, speaks of cow in very specific ways as, for example, being the different parts of the cow are resting places of the demigods. For example, we don't say that about buffalo. We don't say that about camels, but scripture doesn't. So cow has a special place. But, you know, he's speaking of, his question was specifically, you know, for a teenager speaking to teenage friends or audience, how would you? So, you know, they're not going to buy into what your scriptures say, that the cow is the resting place of the demigods, you know. But for us, that's one. And it goes on. In Vedic sacrifice, ghee, and it's specific, cow ghee. So we're using the cow ghee for oblations because of the sanctity and purity of the cow and the cow's milk and so forth. Cow urine and cow dung, it's not the same for buffalo and camels. It's specific for the cow. And, you know, and scientifically one can analyze like that. But it, does that address your question? And if, okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Maharaj, my question is about the death. You gave a very good example of Sanatan Rupa Prabhu going to Vrindavan. So, how could one prepare for such a death? Because it could be circumstance that he was able to go to Vrindavan. He had that arrangement could be have been done or could not have been done. He had a friend who was going to India and who carried him at that last stage. It was very difficult stage to even travel. So maybe not everyone would have that opportunity. So that's my point. So how do we prepare for such a kind of glorious death?
Well, it does happen outside of Vrindavan. I gave one example, Bhakti Richard, and he lived in Brooklyn. And he was cared for, except for Vrindavan, he was cared for in a similar way by devotees who extended that care to him. And he wasn't initiated. He was Bhakti Richard. But, you know, he was a devotee. He was very clearly a devotee. He loved Radha Govinda and loved Prabhupada. He just never got it together to get initiated. So it can be done elsewhere. When the community gathers around the person with devotion, and especially because of the bhakti he was carrying, you know, we appreciate it very much. Okay, we can do the same up front.
Hare Krishna, Guru Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisances. Guru Maharaj, by chanting, can we get rid of attachments?
By chanting, can we get rid of attachments?
Yeah.
Can you get rid of attachments?
Okay. How to practically do that, getting rid of attachments?
Practically how?
How to practically do that, getting rid of
chant
attachments?
Chant defenselessly, that's practically. You know the meaning? So practice, cultivate. Then it's possible.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Oh, and way in the back.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. My question was Vidura explaining to Dhritarashtra about the process one should leave to the forest and unknowingly, like without knowing the family, should die. And but in our, it's from my, since my childhood, what I heard is like the sun should burn the body and like, you know, to the cremations and all that stuff. How far is that from scriptural point of view, is that true actually? If we are going into forest.
You got a long wait. No, that's an ancient Vedic standard. Now, you know, how does one observe vanaprastha life? Literally, give them a gizmo and they're okay. Press the buttons and see what happens.
Sorry, Maharaj, I couldn't stop myself asking.
Let's do it later, huh? To the forest later. Just in short, it's a model that we don't need to literally imitate. It's not so practical for our modern time. So vanaprastha can... Let's talk about it later, huh? Much later. Like a few... Five years from now, ask me that question again. Anybody else? Okay.
I'm trying to frame my question, but I thought I will express my thought process regarding the training topic you are mentioning, Guru Maharaj, and also bringing up the Brahmanical culture. I'm noticing, at the present situation, want to focus more on sadhana, hearing and chanting. Like once I go to work, I'm not able to, take my mind away. It's busy and health restrictions. One thought I'm thinking is, let me do it in such a way, maybe in 5 years, come to the position that I stop working on, try to, do in the positive direction. And, seeing many, too many ways, in terms of, able to survive, maintain. That is one side, and the other side is, you were mentioning taking out, we should lead up to the point of taking care of the elders in the society, care to the devotees. I'm thinking there should be some strategy, it takes time, to come to that point, at the present moment, how we are operating in the, at least at the community level at Naperville, one side is, we are not able to do so much, because of, work and health and all that. And, the other side is if you want to have such culture, it takes time. We should have some kind of guidance plan or things like that. My thought process is going on, so just want to hear from you, from my point of view, how can I, prepare myself for, what kind of steps, what kind of direction. I don't know whether I'm able to say it.
True eloquence is truth concisely spoken. And one who has clarity of thought will have clarity of speech. And the converse is also true. But I think I get the drift of your question. A principle is, as far as our present circumstance permits, try to get a very clear idea of the goal. And that's from, you know, teachers and teachings, what's the goal? And then, according to one's own position, a doable step in the direction of that goal, bearing in mind what the goal is, and bearing in mind the teachings and the teachers that helped us understand the goal. So in all of those things, whether it's elderly or training and education or any other thing you want to put on the list, same principle applies. So I can suggest, you know, a thing or two, but that you could put on a menu and select something that you could possibly do presently to cultivate being Krishna conscious in the workplace. I've mentioned two or three of them while here. And it starts with the consciousness of who you are and who you're serving. And becoming free from the designations, one can cultivate Krishna consciousness in any circumstance. But here's another one, in addition to the ones that I gave. This is something that I learned from the kirtan leader during one of our Harinam periods. His name was Lalit Kumar, Prabhupada disciple, and he carried a little shoulder bag before devotees even knew what shoulder bags were. And inside he had his Bhagavad Gita. And in a very regulated way, we were right in the middle of kirtan. He wasn't leading the kirtan, but in the middle of the kirtan, he'd open his bag, pull out his Bhagavad Gita, and read a verse from Bhagavad Gita. Practically every hour. Throughout the day. And every day. It's very regulated. And guess what? It helped him remember Krishna. Now he had to have the commitment to do so, and had to have enough of motive goodness to maintain the commitment that it helped him remember Krishna throughout the day. You know, why we're on Harinam, besides the Harinam itself. You know, Krishna's message. So there's something you can do in the workplace. Maybe not every hour, but you know, whatever, at intervals of time. You just do a little time out and connect with Krishna. Here's another one. Some prayers that you'd like to enter into the spirit of periodically in the course of the workday, do that. Or here's another one, some verses that you'd like to learn periodically, a little time out, and do that. And during your lunch hour, go and chant an extra round. Or, you know, there's another one. And in short, the list could be much longer, but where there's a will, there's a way. So the circumstance isn't inhibiting. It's the will is weak, not the circumstance is prohibiting. May not be like super conducive work environment, but where there's a will, there's a way. And you'll have to wait till 5 years from now. It's something you can onto, according to your capacity. And so, you know, just so do something that's a little doable. It's a little bit like the question of, you know, anartas that we have and how do we overcome them. Remember that answer. First, just don't obsess about it. Don't put the cart before the horse. Put the horse before the cart. Focus instead on devotional practices. And then you make a list. So same, you can make a list of things that you could do that would help you remember Krishna and be Krishna conscious during the day from 9 to 5. And then pick some of those that are most doable. Just pick one and do that. And then celebrate. And then take another one. And then it becomes part of your life, remembering Krishna. And at first it's regulated, and then it becomes more just natural. And then you'll wonder, how did I get through the day before I was doing these things? Just like, how did I survive without chanting my rounds? I've often wondered that. How do people do it? How do they survive this crazy world without chanting 16 rounds a day? I just like, I can't imagine it. I don't even want to think too much about it. How do they do it? So it just becomes part of your life. Start something doable. And do it. The application. Are we done? Okay, last question, and then we'll have kirtan or something.
Guru Maharaj, I was just capture a little bit the last part of the descriptions of someone facing death. And, you know, the
coming up tomorrow morning is after death. It's not over at death.
Yeah, so is terrifying, and it, for a materialistic person is a very horrible experience. And I'm also thinking that just the experience of having your health failing a bit and how much havoc it creates, you know, in your life, both, you know, in all sense, in all ways. And especially how it does affect, you know, your sadhana practices and the struggle that it becomes, you know, to actually do things that you regularly do with no problem, and all of a sudden, you know, just having all those obstacles and difficulties and lack of energy, et cetera, et cetera. And the frustration that comes with that.
It sounds familiar.
Well, I was going to ask you because I remember admiring and looking up, you know, with great awe, you know, how you dealt with your times that there were some times that you were very sick. And how you dealt with that. So maybe I was going to ask you just to give us some insight on, you know, the way you dealt with poor health and maintaining, you know, a strong practice.
Well, I'll keep it simple because it could get really protracted. I heard that Prabhupada said to a devotee who had pneumonia, and they were in the hospital in an oxygen tent with pneumonia, and Prabhupada went to visit them in the hospital. And through the oxygen tent, they were saying to Prabhupada, I feel so bad that I'm not able, I can't even breathe properly, I can't chant my rounds. And Prabhupada pacified them by saying, it's okay, your first business is your health. Then he stated these priorities. First comes health, and attend to it. That's what you're doing right now. You're in an oxygen tent, attending to your health. And then comes sadhana. And before you begin the number three, that your service, complete your sadhana. And then if you know, whatever surplus time and energy and strength you have, then some service. So that's what shrinks, is service. And it's frustrating because especially active people, hint, mode of passion, active people like to be doing stuff. And we're used to doing stuff. When you can't do stuff, it's frustrating. So, you just have to take shelter of the reality and instruction. Reality is I don't have the energy and the capacity, but I'm not going to neglect health. And I'm not going to neglect sadhana. So I just have to accept the fact that it's saying yes to Krishna kind of thing. I'm restricted. When I have energy, I'll do. And otherwise, now is a time for regathering my health while completing my sadhana. That's just, you resign yourself to that reality. You say yes to Krishna. Now, in my case, different than some other people I know, Krishna restored health in a reasonable time. One time it was, you know, quite a while, a year and a half or something before I had the capacity to do too much. But Krishna restored health, but if he hadn't, you know, just you have to still say yes to Krishna and reduce in that service department. And you'll take shelter of another mode besides the passionate one, that, you know, to run around and do stuff. You know, devotional service as enthusiastic doesn't mean, therefore, that person's in passion. You know, it's not so simple like that. Enthusiasm that's with a spiritual conception of self and who you're serving, it's not just passion. It's spiritual enthusiasm. But that spiritual enthusiasm may have to be redirected towards conserving energy and doing better quality sadhana, because that's something that one can invest when one is weak. You know, you can strive to improve quality of sadhana. That's option. Just accept the circumstances. And give good attention to, you know, proper medical care. Find the best possible or available, you know, caregiver, medical caregiver for the need at the moment. And, you know, do it properly, do it carefully, as service to Krishna. That's like, not just like a defense mechanism, but service to Krishna. That gives enlivenment. That service for Krishna part. There's detail, but that's, you know, a realization or an appreciation. Enthusiasm to do even the medical care is in service to Krishna, and it's, otherwise it's tedious and it's not the same. And the healing is not the same either. The spiritual dimension of doing for Krishna makes all the difference. Okay, thank you all very much. Prabhupada ki jai.